thenewspress.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay, your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11 and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people in Santa Barbara, at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets, and in Montecito's Upper Village. At Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Well, hi, Neil. How are you today?
Well, you know, I was thinking of the reality of the COVID virus causing me, and I probably other people, when we wake up, the first thing we think about is what day is it? You know, it used to be you'd think about the day because of the things you had to do. And since no one has anything to do, it's tough to know right when you wake up what day it is. So I have an idea. I think hopefully the station manager is listening. I think we should have a sticky for refrigerators that says Monday is Money Talk Day. And Wednesday, my other show is about Education Day. This way we would say that when you wake up, the first thing you think about is what's on AM 1290, KZSB.
Well, I'm sure that is what many people think about, given the nature of the Groundhog Day that it feels like throughout this this COVID lockdown. So on that exciting news, we have a guest today who is Peggy O'Toole Lamb, and she is a author, and we are thrilled to have you, Peggy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin today with an interesting headline from the Wall Street Journal this Saturday, and it's entitled, Avoiding Taxes is Easy When You Own a Business. And what the article is focused on is the fact that small independent businesses tend to not report their taxes accurately. And there's a thing called tax gap, which is the gap between taxes that are owed and not paid. And the IRS estimates that that's about $600 billion a year. And according to the IRS, the single largest element in the tax gap is individual income taxes owned by or not paid by owners of closely held businesses where you have, for example, lack of a 1099 form or W-2 form where the IRS can check from an independent source what your income is. And so what the IRS is doing is they're relying on self-reporting. And whether it's because of sloppiness or because of dishonesty, their estimate is that many, many small businesses do not pay their accurate share of taxes. And the IRS is short-staffed, and they don't really have the computer tools to zero in on this problem. And there is a couple of, and the article talks about a couple of suggestions. And one would be that individual small business tax report would have to include a bank statement so they could review the bank statement and see if the flows are correct. But it's interesting that there are, you know, small businesses for whatever reason aren't accurately reporting their taxes.
You know, that seems so difficult for me to understand, given that most small businesses that I am familiar with are using a tax professional to prepare their tax returns. So it begs the question of, is the IRS just grasping at straws, or where are they getting this data from? Where is this hunch coming from that people are paying $600 billion less than what they owe?
Well, I think what it is, every year the IRS, at least they used to, did $50,000 random audits, tax returns,
right?
Just in-depth tax returns of a whole array of taxpayers to see if they could find systemic problems. And I guess that's where this comes from. I mean, one of the problems is, how do you define what income is, what wages are? You know, you're on a small business. Is it wages or is it profit? And they're taxed at different rates. So there is also a judgment call that takes place. So anyway, that's the first article. The second article, I had to go very far for it. It's on the same page. and it's entitled, Want to Keep Your Cash Safe? It's Okay to Be at Zero Return. And the article begins with an obvious statement. It says that a good yield is hard to find. Everyone is chasing yield now because yield is essentially zero if you're going to invest in a riskless asset. And what our favorite columnist, this is Jason Swig from The Intelligent Investor in The Wall Street Journal, says, is that don't get nervous about having a zero yield, because a zero yield, he says, obviously, is better than a minus. And if you are willing to reach out for higher yield to anything other than the safest investment, which has no yield, you're taking some risk. And he gives an example. He said a year ago, people were recommending electric utilities and certain banks and real estate investment trusts and master limited partnerships because they had a high yield. And those stocks in general are down more than 4% this year, and in some cases, 7%. And in the financial area, they're down about 20%. And so he's saying that in order to goose up your yield by a couple of hundred basis points, you really risk having a decline in capital, which at this point, he said, just isn't worth it. So he's suggesting that keeping your income at a pretty low level during this very strange period is probably better than taking any kind of risk and risking your capital.
I couldn't agree with him more. I'm finding more and more conversations. People are really concerned about getting some sort of return on their cash as opposed to just having cash be that safety net. And so it begs the question of whether people feel, you know, if you have your 6-month emergency reserve in place, you really shouldn't concern yourself with how much interest it's getting per se. It's really there as that safety net as opposed to that money maker. And so I couldn't agree with him more that, you know, oftentimes if things sound too good to be true, especially in the zero interest rate environment, it is. And you are risking your capital, which many investors do not want to do.
The next article is entitled Thinking of Quitting Your Job. Here's What Working Mothers Should Know. The pandemic is forcing some working mothers to consider quitting their jobs and staying at home and taking care of childcare. And what there are a few suggestions and pitfalls that this article talks about. First is keep some bills in your own name to maintain your credit score. In other words, if your husband is working, don't let him pay all the bills. Make sure you keep up a credit card and keep up some type of bill paying so that you still are in the game. And then recognizing that there are disadvantages when you return to the workforce. One expert here says that it will probably impact your earning potential. And the best way to at least deal with that is to have a real good story and explain why you did it and understand that it's going to be a harder task than you thought. And what's so interesting about this article is that you would think that with COVID and with people all in the same boat, there would be more compassion for people who have no choice but to stay at home. And this article is saying, and maybe they're wrong, maybe they're just looking backwards, but they're saying the hurdles for working mothers coming back into the workforce is probably going to be as bad as it was prior to the last 10, 15 years.
You know, I read an article that said very, very similar data about the effects that this is going to have on working women in the U.S. and the length of time this is going to set women back in terms of their earning potential is really horrific given all that's going on.
I think I'm going to send my wife back to work just to make sure that she has the ability to have earning power.
Yeah, good luck with that, Neil. Good luck.
And the last article we have is also about women, and it's a little bit condescending, but it's entitled "Why Women Shouldn't Be Afraid to Talk About Money," and it advises women that when they're out with their friends, with their girlfriends, they should not just be talking about things that ordinarily would interest them, but they should be talking about the same subjects their husband do, which is basically money. What this article is saying that when men get together, they talk about the stock market and they talk about investing in real estate. And they basically say that building wealth is partly a matter of focus. And you need to get past the taboo and hangups about talking about money and finances. You should make it okay at a quote unquote girl's dinner. Again, this is written by a female, so I don't feel too badly about it, that you should be able to talk about money, wealth, investing, because the author claims that it stimulates the entrepreneurial spirit and makes you think about investing. Diane, being a female, don't just give me an expression. This is radio.
What do you think? An expression because, like, I don't know. I feel like women do talk about things that matter to them. And oftentimes here, at least, people are talking about real estate investment, talking about 401k savings. You know, I think it makes a gross generalization that every time men get together, they're talking about money. I'm not so sure about that, but, you know.
Well, the men I have the opportunity to talk to basically talk about nothing. So I'm not sure I agree with this article either. But, you know, I always like to give the other side of the story. And so I'm giving everyone a chance to weigh in here. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. Diane, are you going to join us?
I am going to join you. How are you, Neil? Sorry, I missed it. So if you're just joining us, we are thrilled to have with us today Peggy O'Toole Lamb. She is a local celebrity author, and we are thrilled to have you. Peggy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for asking me.
And so let's talk a little bit about you and where you come from and what brought you to Santa Barbara originally.
Well, I was born and raised in the my life. The first to go to college, which I guess is important these days. What brought me to Santa Barbara was UCSB, and that was right during the 70s and late 60s. and during the riots. And again, that's another thing that shaped my personality and who I am. And I've remained in Santa Barbara ever since. I did start my own business at one point, Sundance Windsurfing. I was educated as a teacher of special ed. And that's what I did for over 30 years. Not consistently, I took time off to have children. And now I'm writing books.
So now in the back of your mind, was writing always something that you had had thought about doing and enjoyed doing? And are you following a passion that was seeded long ago? Or is it just something that you kind of stumbled upon?
Well, when I retired, I did start looking into things that I'd want to do. One being art, I started painting. But the writing really didn't start until I started taking a class. And I guess it was to fill time. I enjoyed it. And I think I was pretty good at it, despite what my fourth grade teacher told me, which was I had stagnant writing. And that's something I think teachers and people should realize, is that don't tell a child something like that.
Especially that young, gosh, you know, fourth grade is young to say you have stagnant writing.
It was parochial school. They start young.
Yep. Yes, they do. And so now, so where did you originally come from? So you went to UCSB, but where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in Pasadena. Pasadena, California. Pasadena. Southern California. Yeah.
Okay, great. And so you went to get your teaching credential and education at UCSB, and what drew you to special education as a field of teaching?
I think that might have started in childhood. We had a mentally challenged neighbor who I took a liking to and would play with when nobody else would play with him. And I just think that it kind of grows, and it's kind of innate in people who choose those kinds of paths, that they just are attracted. And I think I still admire all the women and men that I met at Devereaux schools when I taught there. And there's a part of me that thinks they're genuine and honest, and hopefully they will be happy in our society. So I did see a need to help them. And so I went ahead and got a credential in special ed.
That's great. You know, that's kind of a theme of these things in your life that have touched you personally, and you've turned them into kind of your vocation. When I look at your books and your writings, they're all very personal. And your book I'm thinking about is Then I Won't Seem So Far Away, that tells your traveling stories abroad. To your mom. So tell us about that, and tell us where you got this idea to actually do this book, because it's really creative and neat. I thought it was really fun.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was a lot of fun to do it. I was doing it while I was taking a memoir class in Santa Barbara. The letters were found. And this is a typical story. A lot of people will say that this happened to them. I found the letters in a bag my mom left after she died. And when I found the letters, I opened them up and I thought, oh my God, who was I back then? Because it was like maybe 40 years after I had written these letters. And so going through them, I started realizing who that young girl was. And there was a separation between who I am now and who that young girl was. So there was a lot of compassion for her. And I saw, because in the beginning, as you know, my father dies and I take off. And the other thing is that I started to like her as a person. And so in writing the book, I got to get to meet myself back then. And it was a tumultuous time, as they say, in the 70s. And so hitchhiking through Europe and meeting all kinds of crazy characters and having adventures was just so fun to relive, as well as the music. Every time I thought of a place, a song would appear in my head. So it was just a lot of fun to do. It took me a long time, though. It took about 9 years to write that book.
Oh, wow. That is a long time.
Maybe seven. Yeah.
You know,
seven.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because when I moved here 22 years ago, the way you listened to music when you ran was called radio. They didn't have other ways to do it. And I remember listening to the Beach Boys and Mamas and the Papas when I ran. And I said, boy, this just reminds me of my youth growing up in Southern California. Only I grew up in New York. It was sort of like, you know, I had this image of where I grew up, and it was, you know, it was imprinted with the music I liked, and it created a sense of where I thought I was, but I really wasn't.
I think music actually embeds itself in our minds, and they have so many studies about older people, not myself included, I'm joking, but that will actually not be cognizant of what's going on around them, but they'll put on big band music or jazz or something from the era that they lived, and they start moving and they start singing something that they would not have expected before. So memory is funny that way. There's certain things that will click in, and those letters did that for me. Reading the letters just brought a flood of memories back.
I bet.
And what did your kids think of the book?
Well, I had a rule. When they found my 16-year-old diary, I told them, they were really young, I said, you can't read it until after you're 16. So the same thing with this book. I thought, you know what? I did not let them read it while I was writing it. And they were in the formative years that I was writing about. They just moved off to college. They were getting their own life together. So they never read any chapter or anything I wrote until the book was finished. And by that time, they had all their own lives set. Their paths were set. And to be honest with you, they loved the book. Absolutely loved it. To think that their mother would do those things and was part of that whole 70s hippie movement. And so I got a lot of great response from them, as well as their friends, as well as at UCSB. They had me out there also, and the kids seemed to relate to it, which I thought was really cool that they could relate back then. Of course, they love the story of the burning of the bank, and they love the Black Panthers, and they love all those iconic times that when I was living it, I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea that that was going to be something important in history. So as we go through COVID now, I think everyone needs to kind of somehow record it, if not on paper, in music, or in their minds, because this is an extraordinary time that 10, 20 years from now, people are going to be wanting to know, what was that like?
And I think on that note, the other moment, which is a moment of 4 years, it seems like 8 years, that people remember is the Trump presidency, which was so disruptive that I think it's imprinted right now on everybody's mind. On that note, you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jeff Devine from American Riviera Bank. All of our customers were once just like you, stuck with a bank that kept charging more for less. But when they finally made the decision to change banks, American Riviera Bank made the move easy with mobile deposit, online banking, free use of every ATM in the country, and a level of customer service that other banks dream of. Come in and make the move today in our downtown Santa Barbara or Montecito Upper Village branches. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people.
Coming up October 9th through October 18th, it's the third annual Nature Track Film Festival, and this year it's virtual. Here are co-directors Holly Klein and Sue Eisgeier.
We want to excite people to get out, and that comes from the Nature Track Foundation, which is starting at a young age with children, getting them excited about being out, learning about nature.
What filmmakers do now is incredible.
These directors and crew that go out into these environments, you know, into the jungle or, you know, into the ocean, or even, you know, just hiking in the backcountry, they have to deal with everything that's in that environment.
It is just mind-blowing.
Go to our website, which is naturetrackfilmfestival.org.
For tickets and schedule information to see how you can see this incredible virtual film festival, go to naturetrackfilmfestival.org. That's naturetrackfilmfestival.org. Or call 805-886-2047.
This is big. Gelson's is holding a give back day the last Saturday of the month, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Gelson's will donate 5% of all sales that day to Unity Shop, which distributes groceries to the recently unemployed and families in need struggling in the wake of COVID-19. Gelson's and Unity are partnering to help our community, and you can help too. The last Saturday of the month, you'll be making a difference along with Gelson's to benefit Unity Shop.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Peggy, before the break, we were talking about your first book, Then I Won't Seem So Far Away, which was a compilation of letters that you had written to your mother while you were traveling abroad. And it was really neat how you put in really what was happening versus the letter that you wrote to your mom. So when you first read through those letters after going through your mom's affairs after her passing, when did it occur to you to write a novel based upon these letters? You know, because I've got to imagine at first it's that fun kind of walk down memory lane, and then something must have clicked for you, like, hey, I could make a really neat book out of this.
I had already been in the memoir class for a few years, so I knew that I had come across something that had a lot of universal interest, because it was a time that people were interested in, as well it was a time in my life that I had changed. I had left from a Catholic school girl to a UCSB student to a hippie hitchhiking through Morocco and North Africa and Turkey and all over the world. So as far as getting the idea, I wrote it chapter by chapter, and it wasn't until I had my story down that I figured that it had the arc. It had something that I started to question in myself to where I came to some type of an answer. So it really was maybe after writing. I wrote individual chapters or individual pieces on each letter, and then it turned into actually a story that I could create. So I had not the intention when I started.
Now, do you find writing to be therapeutic for you?
No, it's absolutely therapeutic. It's like a meditation and a little beyond, because you lose yourself. So even when I was writing my second book, it was not about me, but I lost myself in the characters. And so time just went by so quickly, and you live in another world.
Right. So let's transition and start talking about your latest book, which is Darling Love Letters from World War II. So how did you come across the story of Frank Foster?
Book is his wife and my mother's sister. So he's not a blood uncle. The letters were given to me, just about 20, 30 of them, and said, you wrote a book about your letters. Maybe you'll write a book about, my father. It was my cousin who gave it to me, about Frank's experience. And I didn't pick up on that until a few years later after my aunt had died. And I found it fascinating reading these letters and going into a world I would never, ever have been interested in before. I don't like war. I protest wars. And yet World War II was such an important war for all of us. And it really did preserve our democracy in the world. So the more I got into it, the more I learned to not just love Frank, but all the men and women who fought in the war. And so now I have a whole new experience of what it was like to be in World War II and what was sacrificed.
And tell us a little bit about how your book informs us of the ideals and characters of the Greatest Generation.
Well, the book is really directly Frank's letters. In the end, my cousin told me she had probably 300 letters, because the soldiers then, when they left, they would say to their wife, "I'll write you every day." And so the only times that they didn't write was when they were under fire or in a jeep crossing the Rhine or some tremendous event that we read about. And I'm reading it in the letters. So the sacrifice for Frank was he grew up as an orphan in an orphanage. And his whole soul and goal in life was to be a father and have a family. He married and his son was born, and within 3 weeks he was shipped to Europe. So he held his son for an hour. And so the rest of the time during the war, which was over about 2 years he was over there, every single letter asked about his son, how John was doing. And so the fact that he could not see his son, and letters took weeks if they ever got to where they were going. And then the other side of the sacrifice was Catherine, my aunt, who had to move back home with her family. There's not a lot of money coming in from the war or from Frank during the war. And so she lived with her family in a small little house, and her mother had problems. And so she had the baby, she had a mother with problems. And so she had to sacrifice a lot too. And yet she had the sweetest attitude. I knew her very well, and she never once complained. And so that's, I think, embodies this greatest generation. They did enormous things. They did things that were heroic, and they did things that were painful and hard and sacrificed. They didn't complain. And they also, when they came back from the war, they didn't talk about it. They didn't want to, for one thing. And I think that's very true with soldiers of today as well, that it's very painful for them to come back and relive it. They also didn't want to burden their families with it. So I look at Frank and Catherine, and I see why they're called the greatest generation. Yeah.
Was there any letters that talked about how he was accepted back into society? Because I don't know how bad it was versus what it like after Vietnam. Was there were people not wanting to engage with them because it reminded them of the war? I mean, how was he brought back into society?
I think it's my connection. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good. There are no letters that I have after November 5th, when he was actually on the boat going back home. And then that was the last letter. But the last 6 months, they had to stay after the war. So from the end of the war in May till November, there was talk about what it would be like going back to the States. And he would make sarcastic comments like, yeah, there's going to be a job for us. What are we good for now? So you could tell the worry was there, how he was going to go back into society. But on the other hand, the people in the United States at that time were fighting the war too on the home front. And so they were together. It was a totally different thing than Vietnam, from what I've read, not Frank's letters, but the people at home, my father being one of them, had three children. He volunteered in the fire department. So he would go out at night with blackouts. And my mother had the Victory Garden. And so everybody was participating. So they didn't, when they came back, they did come back as heroes, but I think they had the same problem of getting back into society, back into jobs. And many of them were shocked too, that just life was never the same after the war.
Well, and I think that holds through no matter what war or conflict mm-hmm. that we send soldiers to is, you know, you lose that, you're gone and you have that sense of purpose, and you lose that when you come back, you worry, what is that going to be? It's much like when business people retire and they lose their identity, recreating yourself in retirement.
Absolutely similar, because he does make a comment in his letters is, you know, what is he going to do, not just for work, but without somebody telling him what to do, or without having, in fact, even right after the war was over, he was constantly on the move, being in Patton's army. They just whipped across, you know, France, then Germany and Luxembourg, the whole place, and not stopping. So that exhilaration after the war was over was gone. And he talks about that, you know, what am I doing here? Why don't they send me home? And he was a good athlete, so they put him on a basketball team. And then he was a first lieutenant. Then they raised his first lieutenant to the next level up. But he mentions, he goes, it's all just fake. We're not fighting anymore. There's nothing really for me to do here. So he had that feeling of loss that he talks about in his letters.
I wonder if the fact that he was from an orphanage, how having this family, people talk about being in the service and having a family that is something that just becomes part of them. And so there must be some kind of withdrawal when you're coming back into the unknown and leaving your friends who supported you.
Absolutely. And they have, in the letters, they have parties that they talk about the friends that they fought with all the way from when he was in Coachella Valley, the desert training center that Patton set up. He had five friends that he stayed with the entire war. And at the very end, they have this big party and they're wondering what they're going to do. And they promise they'll stay together, which they never did. So yes, there was a family for him in the Army.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a Labish Terrier Hound Chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle, simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
We can help him soothe their pain.
Hi, I'm Eddie Tadouri. I'm the founder of the Rhythmic Arts Project, or TRAP, as it's better known. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the work we've been doing during this time of Corona. Our virtual classes have been reaching out and inspiring students around the world, as well as right here at home. Our primary objective is to promote the inclusion of people with different abilities, as well as their typical peers in all aspects of everyday life. Like everyone struggling to make ends meet in our nonprofit world, we depend on donations from folks like you. Please review the website at traplearning.org and give what you can. I'm very grateful.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about.
And if you're just joining us, we have Peggy O'Toole Lamb, who's the author of Darling Love Letters from World War II, with us today. And so, you know, before the break, you had mentioned that your cousin had over 300 letters that your uncle had written to your aunt during World War II. And so how did you go about, you know, your first book was letters, but they were it was your own story. How did you go about researching to find out more about Frank's life, to kind of paint a broader picture than the letters would let you?
Well, that was very interesting for me because I learned so much. First, I took the 300 letters that she had sent on a PDF, printed them out.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and then put him in chronological order because he never dated the letter with a year. And so he was gone between April 1944 and November 1945. So there was, that took a lot of time. And then reading each letter carefully, I cross-referenced what he said in his letters with primary sources. So after the war was over, they had, he was in Patton's Third Army. They have the Third Army After Action Report. So I was able to get into those reports, and they gave detailed information, every single thing that happened during the war in Patton's Third Army. So then I narrowed it down because he was in the 546th Battalion, and it was an anti-aircraft artillery battalion. And he was first lieutenant. So the morning reports, I had to research that too. They sent them to me, and it told every single day where he was. So I used Patton's book, War as I Know It. I used the Third Army's after action reports, the letters, and the morning reports where he was. And then I did all the cross referencing so I could pinpoint where he was and what action took place, because he was not allowed to write about that in his letters. So it was kind of a puzzle that it was a lot of fun.
I bet. How long did that take you in terms of the research piece of this book? Because did you start with that piece?
Let's see, how did I start? I started with reading with the letters. I started reading other people's experience in the war. And then the actual cross-referencing and all that took about 3 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Have you gotten any response from readers who were in the war at that time?
There was actually his best friend's wife who actually I was able to contact, as well as his best friend Kurt's daughter. So I got a little bit of that information, but they were not in the war. Now, he would have been 105 this year, I think. So the people that are left in the war probably are 95. And that's another reason for this book, too, is that we're the last people to tell the story. I mean, because after they're gone, they're basically just a few left, then our families need to, you know, find those old letters and kind of remember them. As far as knowing a person in the war at that time that has read this book, no. I know of another woman whose husband was in the war at this time, and she could confirm that, yes, he was there, yes, they did that. But I haven't met them personally.
You know, it's too bad. It's too bad, because it would probably be really fascinating had you written this book 20 years earlier, because it would have been fascinating to, you know, people who were, you know, in that period and weren't as introspective as he was, to gain some insight.
Yeah, I regret so much not asking even my own mother what went on at that time, my aunt, my uncle. So that's the other thing is, yes, to get this information. Yeah, had I written it 20 years ago, maybe I would have got more information. I don't know. My uncle did not talk about the war. So even his family, when I interviewed his family, there was very little more information they could add.
Hmm. So now if somebody's listening to this interview, and Peggy, and wondering where can they get Darling Love Letters from World War II, where are they being sold at this point in time?
Well, any bookstore can order it. Local bookstores like Chaucer's, they have a few signed copies now, or they will order it for you, which I love using local bookstores. Of course, Amazon has it both in ebook as well as you can purchase it online. And then the publishing company that I used was called Book Baby, and they have it at their store called Book Baby Bookshop. So those are the places. But like I said, any bookstore can order it, because it's on Ingram's, which is the big outlet for books.
And so how'd you go about deciding to go with Book Baby as your publisher?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I wrote this book for my cousins, and I wrote this book for our family. So this was not expected to be a big published book. So I went with the least expensive. And so, I mean, that's just the honest truth. I wanted to look good. I wanted to be professional. So I could have hard copies that, you know, or paperback copies as well as the ebook. But I may look for another publisher because I think it deserves a little more than what I got from the publishing company.
Yeah, publishing has changed today. What you get from the publishing companies mostly is nothing. And even on Amazon, you're asked to pay for your own PR and promotion.
Oh, yeah. Believe me, I know that story. It's again, it was a good thing that I wasn't doing this for money. It was really really something that I wanted to do and enjoyed doing. And there could be money made to maybe, you know, help along. But right now it's satisfying that I wrote a book that people have loved and people, my cousins, relish it. And so, and I think it will be put in some of the museums, the World War II museums and the one down in Coachella Valley where Patton started the Desert Training Center. So there will be more people interested in the book as I get it exposed.
And so with that, you know, both your books are kind of about travel in one way or another. The war, you know, your uncle was in Europe, as were you. Are you an avid traveler?
I have been. Of course, our
right. COVID. Yeah.
I think my favorite trip, but the trip that I had dreamed about for so long, I was able to take in February, which was Antarctica. And so that was probably the highlight. And thank God I got back just as COVID broke open. The other place I visit quite often or have in the past was Bhutan. I generally like places that are a little far flung, more, I like to hike. So I like mountainous regions. I've been to the Alps and in four or five different countries in the Alps. So that's kind of what's been brought me around the world, South America, Africa. So I do. Oh, in fact, I turned 70 and my 70th sign was seventh continent at 70. So
you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB. And believe it or not, we'll be right back with our final segment.
Hi, I'm Jeff Devine from American Riviera Bank. All of our customers were once just like you, stuck with a bank that kept charging more for less. But when they finally made the decision to change banks, American Riviera Bank made the move easy with mobile deposit, online banking, free use of every ATM in the country, and a level of customer service that other banks dream of. Come in and make the move today in our downtown Santa Barbara or Montecito Upper Village branches. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hope you enjoyed your meal. And I just want to say, he's lucky to have a brother like you.
Lucky? Caring for my brother is far from easy. But he's a part of me, like my arms and legs, so I'll be his. No time for tired. Nothing can disable this love. He needs me, but I'm the lucky one, even though I need help now and then.
If you're caring for a loved one, visit aarp.org/caregiving for care guides and community. Support for your strength. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Well,
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Peggy, you know, are you working on a new book after the first two, or are you still just basking in the glory of the two of them?
Well, you know, it would be fun to bask in the glory, but I don't stay too long on one thing. I actually wrote another book in between. So I have a book that's written since it was written after Then I Won't Seem So Far Away and then put under my bed because it's a difficult book. And so I've brought it back out and I'm not sure I will publish it. It is the story of my husband's heart transplant. And so especially during COVID, all those things that we're all having to do with masks and washing our hands and all of that, you know, we had to do that right after surgery, you know, after his transplant. And then, so the whole story kind of gets me a little aggravated, I have to say. So I put it again on the back burner, but it is complete. It is a book right now. So I don't know if I will publish it or not. We'll see.
You know, I don't believe necessarily in a lot of, you know, mystical things, but your husband is much younger now. I mean, his personality is much younger. I don't know if that's just because he's happier or because there's something that goes on when you get a heart transplant.
So this is a big part of the book, Neil. And a lot of times I go, did I make that up? He looks younger. His body shape changed. That was the weirdest part. And it changed quickly. And it wasn't just that he had lost weight. It was just the way he held himself. And there's a lot of stories about how the heart, when it's transplanted, religions believe it's your soul. And so I had a lot of strange experiences during that time. And that's one of the other reasons why it's difficult to write this book, because now I'm reading it again and I'm going, you know, did that really happen? But it did. I mean, I took notes all through from the beginning of, you know, before he got into the hospital to, you know, today. So it may come out in a book. I just have to get my courage up.
Well, I hope so, because because I'm a third party that doesn't know him that well, and it was obvious to me. So I can testify to that.
Well, that's encouraging, Neil. I really is, because again, when you write, you put yourself out there for the world to view you, and they will question you. I mean, the last two books, you would think there'd be nothing to question about, but you get them. You get the questions. Why did you say that? Well, didn't this really happen? So I have to be careful with this last book I'm writing.
Well, thank you so much, Peggy. We are looking forward to getting this book. I hope our listeners will go out and get it locally so we can support our local businesses. So thanks for being here, Peggy, and telling us about your book. And thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Money Talk.
So they remember, it's called Darling.
Are you calling me Darling, or that's the book?
No. I was just going to say the book's name, Darling, Love Letters from World War II.
Okay, great. Remember that name. And thank you all for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
It's